So, last time we were looking at the characteristics of radio transmission and the medium over which you are sending your signal. And so we said a few words about antennas, which were the means by which the radio signal is transmitted. And so again, the key feature of them is that we can either broadcast that signal over 360 degrees, or we can focus it in a certain direction, which gives us a power gain for the signal, so for the power at which you're transmitting the signal, it's being directed in, sort of, if it's being directed in one direction, then you have a gain in that direction. We then looked at what happened to the signal as it traveled through space, through the air, through the distance, and we saw that, well, if the power drops, and how it drops is complicated. So the first effect we looked at was what's called free space loss, which means that it just drops as it travels. So it drops with distance, and it drops as some exponent of the distance it travels. Okay. So it does that no matter what, but in a terrain where, again, signals don't just sort of travel over a direct path, but rather bounce off of objects, bend around objects, you get multipath effects, and you get multiple copies of the signal arriving at the receiver. And again, this is going to have an impact at the power level at which the signal is received. But we, again, assume that it's some exponential factor with distance. So free space loss is distance squared, and we just assume some factor between 2 and 5.5, say. Okay. That picture is further complicated by what's called small-scale fading, which is effects that you observe for small changes in the distance between sender and receiver. And so those effects are caused by multipath and motion. And it can be characterized so relative to the representation of the bit, but again, against this gradual decrease, you also have potentially sort of deep, extreme changes in your power levels. So, what we're going to look at today are spread spectrum techniques. So, we observe that for bits, it's better to have sort of frequency selective fading. So, if the bandwidth of your signal is greater, then you might use components, but you by and large receive the signal. So today we'll look at techniques for achieving greater bandwidth while still allowing sort of multiple users to use the system. So just again on this idea of thinking about having access points, and you have receivers sort of at different positions within the system, and depending on their positions, again, their power level at which they receive signals is going to be different. So if you have one user who's very close to the access point, they'll receive the signal at a greater power than somebody who's far away from the access point. Okay, so what can we possibly do about this? And so this is just, you know, the free space loss problem, or the sort of large scale fading problem. And well, you might just say, well, keep increasing your transmitter power. And the problem with that is that it's sort of a scaling problem. You still have sort of different powers at the receivers. And also, if you have multiple access points, then you can't just keep raising the power, because you'll interfere with the communications of the next access point. So there's some limit to the power at which you can transmit, which means, again, the power at which you receive your signals is going to differ depending on position and possibly other channel characteristics. And yeah, you can't just keep upping the power you send out. Okay, so the effect of different positions or having different received power is going to be seen in errors and hence loss. And so what we need to do, again, is to deal with the errors deal with the different error levels. And so we can look at not just power, but our modulation and coding in order to deal with errors. Okay. So if you have a higher or a lower signal to noise ratio, so your noise is greater relative to your signal, then you probably want to use less levels of modulation encoding, so you want to send less bits per signaling element. So essentially you're slowing down your bit rate, and as we slow down our bit rate, we sort of improve the reception, so we have less errors. We can also use our channel coding, so our error encoding, and we can strengthen the schemes that we use. And so if we're less likely to get errors, we use less redundancy, so we have 2 to 3 in this case. And so for every 2 bits you send, you 2 bits of data, you send 3. And as you go out and things are worse, you increase the number of bits. So here, for every 1 bit you send, you send 2. So, this sort of variable modulation and encoding scheme is used in pretty much any sort of wireless access point, so both cellular and Wi-Fi, and
WiMAX, and you know, pretty much everybody uses this sort of a scheme. And so basically, no matter what, how you're sending the bits, this will improve,
this will improve the reception or the error correction over sort of
for different channel conditions. Okay, so today we're going to look at spread spectrum techniques and
other techniques for improving the reception of
our bits. And doing so in a way that, so basically to improve the reception, what you want to do is you want to send over a greater bandwidth. But if you, unless you find then some way to share the bandwidth among multiple signals, then you're reducing overall the amount of bandwidth available in the system. So the techniques will look at spread the signals, but do it in such a way that we'll actually be able to share the bandwidth among multiple signals. Okay. And so the original technique proposed and adopted was spread spectrum, and there's a pretty good discussion of this in the Stallings Wireless Comms book.
And now most modern systems have moved to OFDM and MIMO systems, and
if you look in the library, there's whole textbooks on that, but I think these couple of tutorials do pretty well for just sort of a basic introduction to the techniques. Okay, so who uses spread spectrum? Well, earlier Wi-Fi systems were based on spread spectrum, and most 3G cellular systems were based on spread spectrum, again, before G moved to OFDM MIMO solutions. And sort of relatively sort of short distance, low power systems also used spread spectrum. Okay, so the basic idea is that our channel encoder is, so it's just our bit modulator is producing a relatively narrow bandwidth signal, and we're going to use the spread spectrum modulation to spread the bandwidth of that signal. And so that, again, improves the reaction to small-scale fading effects. And so, which is fine, except that if a single user is dominating a greater bandwidth, then you run into problems with sort of the overall capacity of the system in terms of how many users. So this is also, on top of this, we can build on a multiple
local access system, so we can use the spreading in such a way that multiple users can share the same bandwidth. Okay. So we'll have a look first at sort of what happens for a single user, and then we can sort of think about, well, how multiple users coexist in the same system. So we think of our user as producing a bit stream, and then that the modulator has some sort of code which is used to spread the bandwidth of that bit stream, those signals, and if you have the same code at the other end, you can re-extract the signal.
So there are two basic techniques for spread spectrum: frequency hop spread spectrum and direct sequence spread spectrum. And we'll look at each of those two. And so frequency hop spread spectrum is
based on top of either frequency shift keying or phase shift keying, and it's going to change the carrier frequency at which the signal is sent.
Okay. And so your whole channel is going to be divided into a number of carrier frequencies, and this will form that number of subchannels.
Okay. So the K here refers to the encoding, and so essentially have if you want to encode, if you have a binary encoding, if it's k bits, then you get 2 to the k
possibilities. Okay. The spacing between the carrier channels has to be related to the bandwidth of the input signal then. So obviously you want to space the subchannels so that the signal fits into each individual subchannel. The way frequency hop spread spectrum works is the transmitter operates on a single subchannel for a period of time, and then it changes to a different subchannel. Okay, so it begins hopping frequency, so you're working in a certain bandwidth, then you need to work in a different bandwidth, then in a different bandwidth. Okay. And so again, the idea there is hopefully at least some of the bandwidths have good channel characteristics. The hop, the sequence of channels, again, is determined by a spreading code, and the spreading code is just some sort of bit sequence or some collection of bits. And for every k bits, of course, you get 2 to the k possible subchannels. Okay. Okay. So, if we look at sort of what's going on at the sender, the original signal is either phase or frequency shifted and transmitted at a base frequency, plus or minus an offset. Okay. And so, again, what we're going to do is we're going to modulate that base signal by a fixed frequency carrier. So in this case, the 2 pi fi, cosine 2 pi fi t. And that's going to have the effect of shifting the signal by fi in the frequency domain. So we can have a look at what it does, again, multiplying the two sinusoids together. We end up with two components at plus and minus, again, our frequency, our carrier frequency. And if we filter this signal, use a band pass filter, then we can keep, again, the sum component. Okay. So, again, the effect of this is to have shifted the signal frequency by the amount of the carrier. We do this at a cost amplitude, but we can, again, move the signal around the frequency domain. So, again, at the receiver, you're going to reapply to extract the signal. You reapply the carrier frequency, and now you have components at 2fi and then at the original frequency, so you can again use a bandpass filter to extract the original frequency component. Okay. So, again, that's sort of the mathematical underpinning, and we just looked at an example for frequency shift key, binary frequency shift keying. You can, of course, do the same thing with multiple levels. Again, now your original frequency has not just two components, but however many, 2 to the however many levels you have components. Okay. And so now you've, again, you have your original signaling element, and then your frequency hopping and you can compare the rate at which you're frequency hopping to the data rate. So
The duration of a bit, of course, is just 1 over the data rate. And so, and the frequency is going to have a rate of change as well. So if the rate of change of the hopping sequence is slower than the change in the signaling elements, then we refer to this as slow frequency hop spread spectrum. And if the rate of change is higher, we refer to it as fast frequency hop spread spectrum. Okay. So typically, in order to, again, recover bits, you want to be spreading the spectrum sort of within a bit, so you want fast
frequency hopping. Okay, so just to take an example, so here our original modulation scheme, signaling elements are representing 2 bits, and we are hopping every 2 signaling elements. So what we see is we start in original, our base position, and we have 2 changes to the signaling elements with 4 bits, and then we change our hop frequencies, we change our carrier frequency. That changes the region, that's the frequency region that we're in, and then we have 2 signaling elements in that region. We hop again, 2 signaling elements within that region, hop again, 2 signaling elements within that region, hop again, 2 signaling elements within that region. Okay, so you're moving around, but relatively slowly. Okay. So for fast frequency hopping, again, we want multiple hops per signaling element. So again, our signaling element is going to represent 2 bits at a time. But now we're hopping twice per signaling element. Okay. So here we're trying to represent bit 00, so down in the bottom in terms of the original signal bandwidth. But we have 2 hops while transmitting that 00. So we start at the bottom and then we hop. And similarly, for the next signaling element, which represents 1-1, we start, we hop, and then hop again for the 1-0, we hop and hop again. So we're hopping twice per signaling element. Okay. So, what we're aiming for is to have a lot of, to again be spreading a lot, which means to have a lot of a large range of hops available to us. And that's going to lead us to good resistance to noise and to jamming. And so if we look at an example with
signal jamming. We assume that our jammer has a fixed amount of power, and so for our original signal, the noise, the jammer signal can be concentrated into a smaller bandwidth, given a higher noise effect. Now, if we use the spread spectrum, well, the power is going to have to be spread over the greater region. So if you have 2 to the k hops, you're spreading your power over those 2 to the k regions. And so, again, your noise component is going to be reduced by those 2 to the k, by that factor of 2 to the k. Okay. So, our second technique for spreading is what's called direct sequence spread spectrum. And with direct sequence spread spectrum, what we're doing is we're spreading the spectrum by increasing the bit rate. Okay, so your frequency, your bandwidth is related to 1 over the duration of the bit. So the faster the bits go, the greater your frequency. The greater the bandwidth you're taking. Okay, so how do you increase the bit rate? Well, you do that by encoding each bit as a sequence of bits. Okay. And so we have what's called a spreading code, and we use that to encode our bits, and so we can think of it as if you have your code, you can think of doing an exclusive OR on the bits. And so what that will do is you have a code, and then each bit is, the complementary, the 0 and 1 give you complementary representations of the bits, of the coded sequence. And what happens then is if we reapply the same code, we recover we recover our bits. Okay. So we start out with a bit, we encode it, we receive the encoded sequence, and we reapply the code, and that will give us our bit back.
So, again,
we can sort of represent it mathematically. We have our original signal, and here we're just going to we do the same thing with phase shift keying, which is plus and minus for 1 and 0. And we can through the exclusive origin, or just by multiplying by our chipping sequence then. And at the other end, of course, when we remultiply by our chipping sequence, that gives us 1, and we can recover your sigma. Okay, so the point of that is you can either code, then modulate, or modulate, then code. It doesn't really matter. Okay. Yeah, so, again, I don't think there's anything too sort of exciting about this. You have your original signal, then you then multiply it by the code.
Okay, so again, this is going to give us good resistance to jamming, and for essentially the same reasons we had before, and look at it in the frequency domain, so again, we could think that we want to, our jamming signal should be at the center, sort of for optimal jamming, the jamming signal would be at the center, central frequency. And now, when we receive a signal, we have our transmitted signal, noise, and our jamming signal. And we are going to despread our received signal. And that will also lead us to despread the jamming signal. The power of the jamming signal is then spread over the bandwidth of the spread signal, but when we are demodulating our signal, again, we're going to use a band pass filter to recover the signal, so we're sort of removing components of that spread jamming signal. So again, we get the same factor of resistance to jamming. Okay, so in both cases, with spread spectrum, we see that we have increased resistance to jamming, and for similar idea, for similar reasons, again, if you have frequency selective fading, you're going to get increased resistance to that as well. Again, the problem with that is, that's great for a single user, but you've just really increased the amount of bandwidth that that single user is taking up. So you start with a narrow signal, now you have a spread signal. Okay. And so if you didn't do anything else, you've really decreased the number of users that you can have in the system. So, what you need to do then is to be clever about sharing the spectrum. And so, code division multiple access techniques allow multiple users to be
transmitting within the same spectrum. And so, how are we clever? Well, we're clever with our coding sequences. So we want to have coding sequences so that somehow we can unpick one user from another user. So let's think about having a number of users and they're each transmitting at the same rate. And they've each encoded, they've used DSS for to encode their bit stream. And so, again, if they're sending over the same channel, what's going to be received is a combination of all of the user signals. So, how do we unpick one user signal from another user signal? And the answer is that we're going to have to use the chipping codes. Okay. So just in order for us to sort of be able to talk about this, we're going to think of the chipping codes as a vector. So if you have k bits encoding your each user bit, then you get a vector of length k to represent the code. Okay. Then user bits are just plus or minus this vector, can be represented as plus or minus this vector. So, if we want to recover a user bit, again, we would just apply our original code to the signal and sort of as an inner product of the vectors. And so if you do that, sort of again, just thinking about one signal, then if you had a 1, you're going to get plus k. If you had a 0, you're going to get minus k. So that's just sort of mathematically how you're thinking about sort of sending and receiving signals. Now, if we can pick our codes so that the codes are what's called orthogonal, which means if you apply one code to another, you get 0, so you zero out your signal, then if you're trying to find user I's signal, if you also get something encoded by user j, by reapplying your code, you're going to zero out user j's contribution. So, if we can pick our codes that way, then we can unpick. The signal we receive is a combination of everybody's, but we can unpick our portion of it. Okay. You can do that possibly even without complete orthogonality, just as long as it's sort of close to orthogonal, so you don't have too many overlapping components.
Okay, so if we look at an example here where
using chipping codes of 6 bits. And so CA is orthogonal to the other two, but CB and CC are not. So if we again took the inner product, we get 1 of CA and CB, we get 1 minus 1 is 0, plus 1 is 1, minus 1 is 0, minus 1 is minus 1, plus 1 is 0. So you would get the 2 bits would cancel each other out. If you look at CB and CC, you get 1 plus 1 is 2, plus 1 is 3, minus 1 is 2, plus 1 is 3, minus 1 is 2. So, again, they're not completely orthogonal. So, each of the users would again encode the message using their own sequence of bits, and again, this just gives us a plus depending on whether you're 1 or 0, you get a plus or minus of that signal. Okay, so again, if we look at a single user sending a signal, so A transmits a bit, then that bit is again split up into a 6-bit sequence, and it's either plus or minus that sequence gives you either a 1 or a 0. When we recover the sequence, again, we just reapply our chipping code. And if you had a 1 originally, again, you're going to come up with all of these 1s, so that's a 6, and if you had a 0, this is going to be minus, this is plus and minus, it's going to be minus 6. Okay. So it's easy to distinguish between those two values. Okay, so you can always distinguish between the 1 and the 0. Okay. So you may receive some other, or you may get some other value, and that's going to occur for one of two reasons. A transmission error has occurred, so something didn't get received correctly. Or someone is transmitting an interfering signal, so the codes for the two signals are not orthogonal. And what you hope is that will compromise possibly a portion of the signal, but you hope that you retain enough of the signal to still distinguish between a 0 and a 1. So if you get a 5, it's more likely to have been a 1. If you get a minus 4, it's more likely to have been a 0.
So even in the presence of some noise, some interference, you should still be able to extract your signal. Okay.
So again, if your codes are orthogonal, then if you have two people sending, then what you receive is a combination of the two signals. But if you then apply your own code, if you apply your own code twice, you just recover the original signal. If you apply your own code to something with an orthogonal code, you zero out that signal.
Okay. again, if it's non-orthogonal, you are going to introduce some signal interference. So if we look at B and C, and they both, B sends a 1, C sends a 0, then what's received is a combination of the two signals. And then to recover B's signal, you're going to want to reapply B's code. And if you do that, you get 4. So that's not the 6 you would get in the ideal case, but since it's greater than 0, we can conclude that it was a 1 that was sent. If you, if we want to apply C's code, then again, you will get a -4, and since this is less than 0, we'll conclude that, so this is the, for C, we'll conclude that it was a 0%.
So the codes don't have to be perfectly orthogonal, but they have to be largely orthogonal.
And again, in the presence then of additional noise, sort of the less interference that you're introducing, the better. Okay, so
one thing that we've done in this is with our chipping codes is we've increased the bit rates and therefore reduced the bit duration. And now, in the presence of multipath, what happens if your bits get shorter and shorter, you have more likelihood of inter-symbol interference. Okay, so as they travel different paths, you're getting different, you're potentially getting different bits received at roughly the same time. So that effect has to be dealt with as well. So what we can do is try to compensate for the delay on various paths by adjusting that delay to what's called a break receiver. And so you will end up getting sort of multiple copies of your symbol. Now, what you don't want is copies of the next symbol or the previous symbol. So in order to be able to effectively combine these copies, you also have to use an orthogonal code from one bit representation to the next. So you have to use a different code, orthogonal coding from one bit representation to the next. And if you do that, you will eliminate any, again, inter-symbol interference. Okay. So the bottom line is that you need sort of more complex
equipment in order to make this work. Power control is also a problem
So what we've been discussing so far is essentially the signals are all essentially received at the same power level, and then you can unpick one from the other. But you know, again, possibly you could be receiving the signals at sort of different power levels, like a close to the receiver, you might get the signal be received at a higher power level if you're far away at a lower. And again, that, if not having the same power levels, is going to make that decoding problematic. Okay. So I think I have a brilliant example somewhere in the tutorial problems, but you can see that one signal can essentially obliterate all the other ones, and you can't then extract it, your signal. Okay, so what we need then is that all signals need to be received at roughly the same power level, and so we have to employ what's called a channel inversion technique. So what you try to do is adjust your power level so that, again, it, at the receiver, it's always the same. And you then do that by measuring your the received power level and then transmitting at an inverse ratio. So the less you receive, the lower power you receive at, the higher power you transmit. And this gives you a sort of rough estimate of the distance between sender and receiver, or the quality of the channel between sender and receiver. Okay. But again, this could cause problems for any adjacent systems. So you're adjusting your power for your access point, but you're also maybe blasting into the territory of the next access point. So it's a necessary
step for CDMA, but it again can cause problems. Okay, so
that's, assuming we have our spreading codes, that's roughly how things work. And what we need now to ask is, well, how do we produce spreading codes?
And, well, what properties should these codes have? And we want them to be noise-like, so that means that their mean is roughly zero. We don't want repeating patterns. Again, that can cause correlation problems.
If we're using multiple access, so if we have multiple users, then we need our orthogonality, our orthogonality. So there's two fairly common methods of producing codes. One is using what's called PN system, so we're just going to try and produce a randomized set of zeros or ones, and hopefully get some orthogonality properties. The other is to explicitly design codes to be orthogonal.
So
the PN sequences have the plus of being fairly random. You can't really predict what's coming up. So in terms of malicious jamming, that's great. The orthogonal codes are quite predictable, but
they're also, again, explicitly orthogonal. So if you have multiple users, that's quite useful. Okay.
So it's impossible to, or very difficult anyway, to generate sequences that don't repeat ever. PN generators will produce sequences that do eventually repeat based on the characteristics of the generator, but it's very hard, observing the pattern, it's very hard to determine the original generator. So once you've observed the whole sequence and you can infer if it starts to repeat what it is, but you can't figure out how it's generated, so it's unpredictable. It's got, again, a number of desirable properties in terms of looking completely random. Okay.
So it gives you roughly half ones and half zeros. And
it's not likely to give you long runs of either ones or zeros.
It's also reasonably orthogonal with shifted versions of itself. So again, if you're worried about symbol interference, then it will be giving you these. Each coding will be orthogonal to the next, so you aren't going to.
So you can eliminate the inter-symbol interference.
Okay.
So PN sequences are usually generated using what's called a linear feedback shift register. And nice, it can be implemented easily in hardware. It gives us the randomness we're looking for, and we can produce long periods. So we're just going to have a quick example of how it works. Sort of a small example of how it works, but obviously, you have to generate bigger periods, you need bigger generators. Okay. So it's a shift register in the sense that you're keeping a number of bits and to generate, again, the next portion of the sequence, you shift your bits and you feed back the first of the bits. So you can, your output is for each time a single bit, and what's fed back is a combination of the bits in the register. Okay.
So LFSRs have the, again, nice periods.
The output is periodic with a maximum period of 2 to the n, where n is the number of bits for keeping. And you can always find some kind of configuration to give you your maximum period. You'll never get all zeros unless you start with all zeros. And so the M sequences are the resulting sequences of period N.
Okay, so we can generate these sort of as big as we want. And so to see how it works, we have to start out at some initial state, which is
anything but zeros, anything but all zeros. Okay. And the output is B0, and we then shift all our bits, so B3 goes to B2, B2 goes to B1, B1 goes to B0, and we feed back a combination of the bits into B3, so that combination is B0, exclusive OR with B1, so in this case, 0. Okay, so again then, our output will be 0, and we shift everything forward, and we take a combination of B1 and B0, which will give us 0. Again, shift everything forward then. Get an output, which is B0, and B3 is a combination of B0, B1 and B0, which in this case is 1. So you keep going, and again, our N is 4, so our period, assuming we have our maximum period, is 16 minus 1, 15, and we see that, again, when we hit 15, we're back to where we started. So we get 15 unique values, then we're back to where we started. And, of course, the cycle will start again. Okay.
Okay, so there's a number of properties that can be proven about these sequences. They have roughly the same number of zeros and ones. Or they have the same number of zeros, well, roughly the same number of zeros and ones. Okay, so if we take any combination, then in terms of combinations, they're always different. And again, there's not going to be long runs of either zeros or ones. Okay. So it has this very random look to it. Okay.
And again, if you shift your sequences, well, if you hit a period, obviously there's full correlation, but on any sort of other, shifting by any other amount, they're not correlated. So if they're not correlated, then we, again, can deal with inter-symbol interference. If you have different sequences, well, if you generate your sequences using different generators, then again, you have low amounts of correlation.
Okay, so
it's possible to improve on these usually by using combinations of multiple bazaars.
They give you longer sequences with slightly better correlation properties. Okay. So those have reasonably nice properties.
Another way of generating codes is to explicitly build the codes so that they are not correlated.
Okay, and the most common set of uncorrelated or orthogonal codes are the Walsh codes. Okay. And so these are easy to generate, and also you can generate sort of up to any size.
And so you generate the codes recursively. You start with your base one by one, and then from there you build up a 2n by 2n, so from 1 to 1 you get 2 to 2, 4 to 4, 4 by 4, 8 by 8, etc. The way you do this is by building up larger matrices with 3 copies of the code and then a copy of the complement of the code. Okay. So all rows are orthogonal to each other. Those are the knots of the rows. If you use shifted versions of the codes, then they're not orthogonal. Okay, so you have to synchronize your system, or
some other way account for intersymbol interference.
So again, just a look at how this is working. You start with your one by one. Yeah, you're one by one, then you generate two by two, so you have the original copy and then the complement. Then four by four, two copies and the complement, and then keep going.
Okay, so this allows you, again, to easily generate sort of any size of code you would like. We can use the different sizes of the code now to compensate for users running at different data rates. And so essentially you use the code to bring the transmit rate up to whatever sort of maximum you want. Okay. And so if a user's running at a lower data rate, they can get more encoding. So the larger code, and if the user's running at a smaller data rate, they get less encoding. Okay. So if we have a minimum data rate, our min, and we have a spreading sequence associated with that, and it's from 2 to the n bits per bit transmitted. Then, again, if you are running, if you're transmitting at double the rate, you just use half the code. So 2 to the n. So in that way, the received signals are all at the same rate. Okay. And again, we can use our Walsh codes to easily generate the different encodings. Okay, so that's spread spectrum. And so, again, the desire is to broaden the bandwidth over which you're sending your signal, and that gives it immunity to noise. But, again, we have to use our band. We only have a limited amount of bandwidth, so we have to use it efficiently, so we then have to share the bandwidth among multiple users. And so in order to share, we have to be clever about how we are sort of using our codes, our spreading. And this does become sensitive to delay and multipath effects. So, again, these were used sort of, these are used in older systems. Again, like the 3CDMA pickings were popular for 3G. And sort of early versions of Wi-Fi, but you do sort of, you end up running up against limits in terms of capacity. So more modern systems, again, have moved to different encoding techniques. So we now use what's called orthogonal frequency division multiplexing to encode signals. Okay, and we'll see that that allows us to spread our bandwidth, but share it efficiently without having to go to these complex coding systems. Okay. And these are used by all the modern systems. They were, I think, first proposed in the context of WiMAX, but now everybody's pretty much using them. Okay. In conjunction is the use of MIMO, and so we'll have a little the discussion of what MIMO is as well. It's not that OFDM is so much better suited to MIMO than the other techniques. It's just like everybody's using OFDM, and it is well suited to MIMO. So you use the two together, and you can get sort of very, very good results. So we'll take a little break now, and when we return, we'll finish off talking about OFDM and MIMO.